Yeah, that'd be fine. You know, I think most people in America know the Exodus story through movies. Most people have never read scripture about it. Most of us Christians haven't spent that much time in the Old Testament. And who knows in this room that there is even a modern skeptical claim that the Exodus story is all merely myth? Has anybody heard this before? I don't know what it's doing.
I never heard about it as a myth. I know it's true.
Sorry, I've messed up my own thing. Jacob, have you done this before?
Yeah, you just use these.
Yeah, but how do you get the screen fixed? It's fixed. Okay, all right. Two things in that picture. One, Deborah Kerr is in there, and she's supposed to be back at the palace. And two, the way they portrayed it, Yul Brynner's coming hot down the trail and gets stopped by the pillar of fire. Why he couldn't go around the other rock and still catch them is kind of in doubt. But there is a modern challenge to the biblical narrative. So first, let's kind of review what the Bible says and then talk about the skeptic claims about the Exodus, because this is becoming quite something if you get into chat and discussion about the veracity of the biblical accounts. Genesis obviously has been under assault for quite a while, but so has Exodus. In fact, there's quite a bit of strident claims against the history of the Exodus. So if we just look at the text, in Genesis, the Bible tells us that Joseph placed his father and brethren in the land of Ramesses. That's a specific name reference, but it's curious. And then in Exodus 1:11, it tells us that when the Hebrews were enslaved, they were tasked with building store cities of Pithom and Ramesses. That, I've got the spelling here from a Jewish translation Bible. Then in 1 Kings, it gives us kind of a ruler and year span reference. It gives us the fourth year of Solomon's reign. 480 years prior to that is when the Exodus occurred, when the Hebrews left Egypt. However, if you go through the book of Judges and add up the events, you come with about a 450-year span between Exodus and Samuel, or rather Exodus and Saul. So then you have Exodus, 40 years wandering. You have that 450-year span. Then you have whatever it took for the conquest. Then you have whatever it took for the 450 years. Then you have whatever it took during Samuel's time before Saul was appointed king of Israel. And then you have Saul's reign of 40 years. Then you have David's reign of 40 years. Then you have 4 years under Solomon. So you're coming up now with over 600 years between the Exodus and the building of the temple. So there are two different dates, year spans in there. Then follow with Acts in the New Testament. The New Testament gives language that it's about 450 years from the Exodus to Saul. So one thing you have to realize is that modern secular scholarship takes the place reference over the ruler and year span reference in the text. And most modern scholarship tells us that the Bible's claim is that we should look for the Exodus in the time that these store cities were built. Now, that has two problems, but let me go to their claim. So there are skeptical assertions going on about the Exodus account. One, that there's no archaeological proof that Hebrews were in Egypt. Two, that there's no evidence that the plagues occurred or that the Hebrews were a slave population in Egypt. Three, that there's no trace of a large people group traveling through the Sinai at any point in history. Four, that there's contrary evidence against the story of the conquest when the Hebrews got to Canaan. that those stories in particular started this line of skepticism. It started with Kathleen Kenyon's digs at Jericho in the 50s. So this skepticism line has really been building since the 50s. And a lot of us are not aware of how many people are relying on this skeptical claim and saying, ha, the Bible's not believable because Exodus is a fairy tale.
They just blindly believe it, right?
Well, there's authority behind that claim. So the current secular posture on the Exodus story is that it is a legend brought up by Israelites in about the 8th century B.C. So, Dan, I'm sorry. Well, I'll get to that. I'll get to that. And so their chronology is based on going to the building of P. Ramesses. And that dates to about 1250 BC. Now, if you know that most scholars put Solomon's reign starting in about 970, 966 BC in that region, then both the 480-year reference and the 600-year reference, that's completely at odds with the biblical account. But they're only using one line in the Bible in most modern secular scholarship to place when the Exodus occurred. And they're just basing on when they think that city got built. So it's a very good scholarly question anytime anybody positions to you that the Exodus is a fairy tale, you can immediately counter, well, but that's not really very scholarly, professionally, you know, coming up with an opinion about what the Bible says. Because in the Bible, if you remember the earlier slide, the Bible says that Joseph brought his father and brothers into Egypt under Ramesses. Well, then are we supposed to believe that the Bible also tells us that 430 years later, after a period of slavery, they finally got out of Egypt under Ramesses? How long did Ramesses live? So per scholarly papers on, you know, and they've done a lot of digs, and in the New Kingdom Pharaoh line of kings, there in the 19th dynasty, you have all these successive Ramesses. There's a Ramesses I before Ramesses the Great that, you know, stars in Cecil B. DeMille's movie as the Pharaoh of the Exodus. So the question is the Bible telling us that Ramesses II was the Pharaoh of the Exodus or not? It would be hard to make that claim if you really sit down and read the scripture. Only by reading it very shallowly could you come up with that conclusion.
So only are these last pharaohs Ramesses?
The last one's going vertically down. And if you're used to construction schedules, this is when you're trying to finish the project, I guess. And Ramesses the Great is the longest green bar there. For people who can't read this chart, Ramesses the First is the first little green bar under that midline orange bar. Yeah, John.
The term Ramesses or Ramesses.
Ramesside. Yeah.
Ramesside. That's a good word.
Yeah.
That the term can be used totally independent of any. Pharaoh.
Yes.
That's a mistake a lot of people make, that they don't know that. And the use of the term Ramesses could be scripturally a reference to the current territory. The territory that was.
Let me reinforce that as we go along. Because I know where you're going, and I think it's kind of in here.
Like Los Angeles, if it's buried.
Exactly.
And 300 years later.
Because place names is a part of this in terms of looking at the biblical account and seeing does it hold water, and what's a logical conclusion looking at the evidence. I did this little chronology chart, which is a little messy, but on the top you have kind of the cultural ages of the whole Middle East. In terms of the Bronze Age, followed by the Iron Age, so on and so on. The Bronze Ages are split into different middle and late Bronze eras. And in the middle bar is the three kingdom periods of Egypt and the dynasty number as you go along in that history. One thing to note here, everybody should know, the old kingdom is when they built all the big pyramids. And then the middle kingdom is when they were really kind of like, that was the highest achievement level of Egyptian culture in terms of poetry and art. And then in the new kingdom, they kind of restored their greatness as a purely Egyptian to monarchy, you know, the lower and upper Nile both going. So in the dark periods in between on that chart are what they call the intermediate periods of Egypt, when Egypt basically kind of went under a general collapse, and there's more sketchy history during those periods. In fact, in the second bar, the Middle Kingdom, I've got one cross-hatched in red before you get to the next brown section of an intermediate period, because there's kind of a controversy within scholarship of when the Hittites commanded Lower Egypt. And the problem with that is a lot of the dig sites in the delta of Egypt, they find Semitic artifacts, which immediately raises a flag to you. What do you mean there's no Hebrews if you find Semites in the delta? Who are they? They're not going to find a menorah in this time period because the temple's never been built yet. So how are you identifying who's a Hebrew from archaeological digs? You can only really identify in that time period of history whether or not these people were a Semitic people. Yeah, Ross, you had a question? No. So that's that crosshatch is a disputed realm of when the Hyksos invasion occurred, and Lower Egypt and the delta about up to Memphis got seized from the Egyptian Empire and got ruled by a Semitic people out of the Canaan region. Because there's a lot of evidence for that. But people dispute from the digs, when did the Hittites invade? And also, you know, when did the Egyptians ever say they had got invaded? Because the Egyptians didn't like to write in their history, we got sacked. And so the reason all those dynasty squares are jumbled in there is because they all overlap during that intermediate period. They're counting as a dynasty, both the Hittite ruler and the Egyptian ruler in the south, when they talk about Egyptian dynasties in that literature. And on the bottom is just like the biblical timeline and what I was just displaying to you. There's three different dates of the Exodus if you go to scripture or to modern scholarship, which is kind of flagrantly wrong as far as a biblical interpretation. So if we focus on that Middle Kingdom dynasty, this is just a list of names of the various pharaohs. So I'll just name them off so you can kind of log them in your brain a little bit as I talk about the next slides. You had Senusret, and then Ameninhat II, then Senusret II, then Senusret III, leading to Ameninhat III, and then Ameninhat IV, and it finally ended that dynasty with a queen named Sobekneferu. So those are just, you know, names to log. But the biblical story sequence is that Joseph was carried to Egypt by a caravan after being sold by his brothers. They got jealous over his multicolored coat. The Hebrews moved to Egypt during a famine. Joseph had resolved the famine within Egypt, was able to save his family in Egypt because he had a position of power as a vizier at that time. The Hebrews then prospered in Goshen, which is a region of the Nile Delta, and they multiply. They're prosperous. And Joseph is vizier. He passes it on to his sons before the Hebrews are put into slavery. Then a new pharaoh comes on the scene. He does not like the situation. He puts the Hebrews into a slavery condition. And they really groan under terrible conditions. You know, slavery, as described in the Bible, isn't like indentured servitude. It's really like blacks in America. It's bad slavery. It's not like the breadth of history slavery. This is one of those few windows when slavery actually was what Americans would define at it from our experience. But the Hebrew population grows under that hardship, according to the biblical account, even though the Egyptians are trying to control the population by killing off male children. Then God finally releases the Hebrews through Moses' agency, puts Egypt under plagues, and the final plague would be one we might expect to find digging in the soil, which would be death in a plague condition of multiple human beings. Then the Hebrews leave Egypt. Now, modern scholars snipe that you can't find evidence of the Hebrews in the Sinai, but you should also be able to find evidence of Bedouin by the same reasoning, because if people are living in tents and carrying all their belongings with them, what are you going to find except an occasional dropped pot? What else are they going to leave? So, and campfire remains. And you find lots of that all over the Sinai, including ancient pots. So I don't know how you tell one ancient pot from another. You can tell what era it is, and they do find that all over the Sinai. And then finally, in the conquest of Canaan, starting with Jericho, that's significant evidence. So I don't know if I'll get into the conquest, because that's quite a bit of time to look at all the cities of Judea and what evidence is there. So anyway, what you have in Egypt in the Middle Kingdom period is they actually have physical pictures of people from Canaan coming in to trade in Egypt. This is from a tomb called the Bini Hassan tomb on the west side of the Nile. And on the top bar here, you see a group of men with spears, and they have livestock with them. And then the lower picture, you see these men. This is the only time period, because there's other time periods where the Egyptians drew art where they showed people coming in from the Canaan area. But this is the only time frame where the Canaanites coming in are wearing multicolored coats. And isn't that interesting that they recorded that in the Semitic culture of the Levant are coming people who have multicolored coats? Well, you can't tell, just like you can't tell now, a Palestinian from a Israeli from a, you know, it's hard. If they're native to the region, there's a bunch of people groups within the Levant, just like there is now.
Yeah, could you go back a slide, please?
Yeah.
Was that during the same period that...
That's Middle Kingdom. I think they date this to 12th Dynasty.
Okay, so...
Or 11th Dynasty.
Jews also in Goshen at that time?
That's coming. It's coming.
So what year is this supposed to be then?
This is Bini Hassan's tomb. They date to, I think, the 11th or 12th Dynasty.
Is this before Joseph?
Well, this is around the time frame we should expect to see Joseph if we're looking at the year span to trace Exodus and then back up 400 years from there. So we should be backing up 400 years from either 1450 to 1600 BC based on the biblical account, then backtrack those 400 years. We should be at around 1850 to 2000 BC, expecting to find them. And here we find them, and they're in that time period. This is without messing with chronology, which I'll get into. Chronology is a little bit fluid at this point in history. They've had a steady chronology of the Egyptian dynasties, and where people think it's like an encyclopedia and it's set in stone, it's not. Yes? Well, 10 plagues, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's a typo. Yeah. In the chronology, there's a lot of evidence that has come out of the ground in Egypt, and then there's also textual evidence that's really quite old. But a lot of the current chronology is based on the guy that discovered the Rosetta Stone, Champollion. After he developed his methodology for deciphering hieroglyphs off the Rosetta Stone, it took him a while to do that, he took a trip to Egypt to then test out his new skill set and see if he could find anything in all the temples that people couldn't read. And he went to Karnak and he read in the temples in Egypt, they had the history on the outside of the building and they had all the holy text on the inside of the building. And so he went to the outside of the building and he read the subscription, all the hieroglyphs. And he thought he identified a Egyptian pharaoh who seemed to have phonetically the same name as a pharaoh mentioned in the Bible. Now, the Bible doesn't say pharaohs by name until you get up to Shishak, who raided into Israel and took the ark. So Champollion thought that he had seen Shishak in the hieroglyphs at Karnak. And so then he established that to tie Israel and Egypt together in their chronologies. But since people have read into that same account in the temple at Karnak, that the Pharaoh's record of who he beat up and how he, his route of his travel up to Israel to clean house, that he went through the northern part of Israel, not the south. So he went through Israel, he didn't go through Judah. And that kind of upset whether or not this was the same Shishak mentioned in the Bible, because he would have had to gone to the south to pick up the ark in Jerusalem. He couldn't have been going just to the north. So that alone upsets a lot of the traditional chronology. People are still sticking to it. And I'm not trying to deny it in what I'm showing you. It still fits, oddly enough. But people are starting to challenge that chronology, and not the whole, it, when you challenge the chronology, you don't challenge the whole time bar and shift the whole thing at one time. You're going to take the Middle Kingdom and the later kingdom, and you're going to shove them in different relationships to each other. Maybe some of the overall timeline loses or gains time as people accurize the chronology, but a lot of it is shifting when certain pieces of it fit in relation to each other. And that's still fluid at this point in scholarship. A lot of people think it's not, but in fact it is. In fact, there's a lot of chronology scholarship going on where they've discovered an ancient Babylonian text as an example that gave us an astronomical event visible from Babylon, where you had a lunar eclipse and a solar eclipse tied together on the same day. And tracking back, like you can do now with computers and astronomical software, they picked the exact day when that happened that's on that cuneiform tablet from Babylon. So doing that, you now have a Babylonian king tied to a specific date that never was before. And he ties to the other cultures of the region. So there's new data coming in. And people treat this like it's settled, like it's climate science, and it's not. So that's one thing to remember as you talk about this to anyone, is a lot of the skeptics who throw the Bible under the bus say it's been settled. Archaeology has dug it. The chronology's finished. It's done. Bible's unhooked. And that's not true for a lot of reasons. The primary one, they're not even reading the Bible correctly. So in Egypt, the second phenomena in the pattern that we would look for is a famine that's caused by the Nile from Joseph's interpreted dream. This is what the Nile looks like when flooded, which doesn't occur anymore since they built the dam at Aswan. And a farmer trying to work the fields. I put this slide in because obviously if the Nile has loaded the delta with water and it takes time to drain out of flat territory, if you get too much water, it's going to delay your growing season. And the farmer trying to work even in this wet field, he can't even do that if it looks like the picture on the left. And oddly enough, remember those names of Egyptian pharaohs in the Middle Kingdom? We have these two pharaohs that don't look like pharaohs from the rest of Egyptian history. This is the only time pharaohs got depicted in this way. They're always omnipotent demigods of Pharaoh. Here we have these two succeeding pharaohs. Senuseret was succeeded by his son Amenemhat. Their reigns overlapped. And what do you see in their faces? Their ears are tipped forward to hear the complaints of the people. They have worry lines on their faces. So these are sympathetic pharaohs, the way they're depicted. It doesn't look like the rest of the pharaohs where you see their statue. On the left is Senuseret, who was earlier in the 12th dynasty. And then from off in a different dynasty, Amenhotep is kind of the typical, you know, tut face you expect to find on an Egyptian pharaoh depiction. And Amenemhat from two different angles in the middle. See how different their personality is in the way they're depicted. So this kind of leads you to say what went on during the reign of those pharaohs where they were depicted in such a sympathetic way. During the Middle Kingdom, in that first intermediate period between the pyramid builders and the Middle Kingdom pharaohs, the Sudan from the south, the Sudanese tribes would come up and raid in Egypt. So when Egypt got strong again, they built forts at the second cataract of the Nile called Semna and Kumna, or Kuma. I don't know if it's visible on my slide, but those two forts had steps leading down to the Nile cataract, which is all those rocks bridging the river here. And they recorded in notches on the rock the flood levels of the Nile in different years. And a lot of those marks are still there, although today they're buried under the Aswan Dam flood. But people have those recorded. They're not all, the marks are not all there. Some of them fell off the canyon walls, and you can't see what the Nile flooded to in those years. But during the reign of these pharaohs, that chart looks like this. And right in Amenhotep III's reign, the Nile flood level went from 18 up to near 22 meters. And at least 7 years in a row. And what those numbers mean is when it went up, what is that? That's like 5 meters. Well, water-wise, that's four times the volume of the water in the Nile flooding down to dump into the delta. That's significant. That means that the delta couldn't dry out for several months when these floods occurred. These were historic floods, and in the rest of the records, they never got as high. After that 7 years, there's some of the rock walls fell off, and you have missing a couple years, and then you have a couple more big floods. So the total span of big floods is more than 7 years, but we don't know if it dropped in between or not from this data. But the data tells us that that flood occurred during the reign of that pharaoh. And something else funny happened during that time of Egyptian history. They cut a canal from higher up the Nile to drain down parallel next to the Nile and dump into a basin called the Fayum Basin, they call it today in Arabic. This was a major engineering project that the pharaohs undertook. And what it did, what it was capable of doing was taking half the flow of the Nile and dumping it into that basin where it could be and then metered out into the delta. So it was a really serious flood control project. It's still there. Most of the original Fayum Basin has been silted in by use of this waterway. And guess what it's called? Here on my slide, it's called the Bahr Yusuf in today's Arabic, means the waterway of Joseph. It's been called that for as long as anybody can remember. So why in an Arabic culture spanning obviously centuries before the Arabic culture came on and would have naturally erased this place name, the place name has stuck. And the pharaohs of that 12th dynasty built their pyramid complex, and they built smaller pyramids. This is the pyramid of Amenhotep III on the right here, which was just a brick pyramid. Most of it's kind of worn away by this time. But he built it right next to that waterway. Yeah.
So this waterway of Joseph, you say as long as anyone could remember, are you saying like it goes?
Goes back at least before the Persians and Greeks ruled Egypt. So you're talking, it's been called that as far as anybody can tell because of Egyptian historians who are later referenced in later histories. There's some histories that don't exist anymore, and they're referenced in other historians that date to like 400 BC. And the earlier historian is referenced in some of his information. So you get a bridge back to time, even if you don't have the original text. And then what's interesting in the Delta region is the advent of ground imaging. Back in the 70s. I don't know if you remember reading a geographic article back that far, but they started getting very excited because Egypt was going to get opened up and a lot of things discovered because they could ground image all the farmland in the Egyptian Delta and see where there used to be settlements that are really ancient, right under the crops. And so this imaging gave them that ability. What started them was they were looking for Tanis, which was the city that the last Egyptian pharaohs ruled from. They finally found Tanis, and when they found Tanis, they found that a lot of its stone had been quarried from an earlier city. Then when they traced that stone, they ended up finding P. Ramesses at around the location of Tel el-Daba in the delta. And what's significant is that is they finally had then found P. Ramesses. And then when they dated that, they thought they'd finally pegged the Bible for when the Exodus occurred. And then that led to them saying, well, gee, if that's the basis of it, it's wrong. Because the conquest doesn't look right. Hebrews living in Egypt doesn't look right. They're not there during Ramesses II. So now we've concluded the Bible's wrong. That's what led to it. But what's imaging, the interesting thing on the imaging is the land of Goshen happens to be concurrent with that grouping of orange dots. For the whole Nile Delta, for ancient history, look at where the people are really grouped, where there was an abnormally high concentration of people in one district of the Delta. This also matches the Bible. And within that complex of the old city of P. Ramesses, when they dug down it, under it, I'll go slip to the next slide and come back, they went to deeper strata below the level of P. Ramesses, and they found a whole different city, which they've labeled Avaris. And nobody can tell you that Avaris is what the ancients called it. It's the modern label for that city. But it's a different settlement there in the Delta. And so P. Ramesses was built over the ancient city of Avaris in that pink region. In kind of the blue region here, it never got built over again by the Egyptians. And in fact, that branch of the Nile is no longer there. This was called the Pelusiac branch of the Nile because it ended up in Pelusium at the coast. But that branch of the Nile silted up and it's gone. They did ground borings to find where there was settlement and where there was riverbed. And so they've mapped it pretty well, where the water used to flow in that time period. The dark blue is the normal river channel. The light blue is the flood stage. So you can see where they built to stay out of the expected floods. And in the lower district on the lower left are some of the interesting digs that they've uncovered since really about the mid-80s. In the mid-80s, I think it was 87, on the right is the actual document from the archaeological digs that the Austrians have been doing for years. And that's just another example of how it looks when they're unearthing these old settlements. There's basically the foundations with some artifacts in between them that they find. Yeah?
Isn't in the digs on Avaris, that's where they found Semitic presence?
A lot. And it's interesting what they found. This is the Semitic hallmark that you see in these digs. Yeah, Ross? Yes. A lot of that is behind the difference of opinion on when the what they call the Hyksos invasion occurred, because a lot of the artifacts look similar culturally. So it's a little fuzzy, and some people pick one story, some people pick another. I saw a fascinating video on the archaeologist who's been in charge of these digs at Tell El Daba for, I think, 25 or 30 years, is a guy named Manfred Bitok from Egypt. And there's even Dan mentioned there's a documentary out called Patterns of Evidence that is really good, but there were some holes in it that the skeptics poked in. And every time Manfred Bitok is talking to the public, he always has one or two Egyptian antiquities people behind him monitoring what he says, because there is political sensitivity in a Muslim Arab country, especially when you get around the firecracker of, hey, the Jews were here. That's tough. But the finds they find are that there's camels for the first time. The Egyptians didn't have camels, these people did. They had sheep, the Egyptians didn't. The most significant thing is somebody of high rank within that culture got buried. They would bring him in on a cart and bury him. They would sacrifice sheep, which sounds like whose culture, and bury them with that chieftain. And they would also bury the camels that brought the cart to the burial. So you have animal sacrifice in kind of a ritualistic way with this culture. The people were buried laying on their side. The Egyptians were always buried laying on their back with their arms crossed. Always. You have Semitic adzes, Semitic pottery with these people. And their house forms are a house form that goes to northern Syria. And if in the biblical account, the Hebrews brought their wives from the land of Haran, which is up near Damascus, brought them down to live here. So you'd expect if they're going to build a house for Sweetie in their new land, it's going to look like what she grew up in. And that's what these are. They're called Mithsal houses. And they're found here in this Avaris and in Goshen. There's a lot of Goshen, obviously, that hasn't been excavated yet for that whole big grouping of settlement in the area. They focused on this first because it dated to, or it related to P. Ramesses. That's what got them interested here first. And it's kept going because they, what they do is they rent a field every year and they get to use it to dig in. The next year it's growing crops again because they throw the dirt back in when they're done and that's gone. You get one opening and then it's destroyed after that. You're never going to find anything else in that site. So they're very thorough when they excavate an area and record everything. That's what they found in the settlements is this pattern of house. Moreover, as the Bible records that these people in Goshen prospered, you find artifacts of a Semitic people prospering. You have a bronze decorative belt that's a Semitic culture artifact. Bronze daggers using a lot of metallurgy, that indicates wealth in the ancient world. You're not a poor guy and own metal daggers or metal ornamentation. So in the ancient world, that's a pretty high marker that these people were doing well, down on the lower strata at Avaris. And then coming on in Avaris, the kings also had a summer palace on the northern island there, where they had a 12th dynasty temple and palace in that section of the city. The southern section was where the Semites lived. And within the Semite section of that city was a palace for a non-Egyptian. And the palace is of such a construction that you would very readily conclude this was a vizier who was a non-Egyptian. The archaeological dig map of it is on the left. On the right is a more readable graphic that this documentary put together. What's very curious about that palace is the original portion is in orange on the left, and then it had additions, which are the blue section on the right. When this building was first put up, it had a portico facade of 12 columns in front of the receiving room, which had four columns, and a columned room, in other words, a room that was big enough to demand intermediate support, very rare in the ancient world. It's a sign of high rank. Remember that when you see the picture of it, because it's quite small in a modern frame of reference. But in the biblical account, remember that Joseph had two sons. This is the actual dig photograph of that receiving room in that palace. The circular holes are the sockets where they would have a column base. And the Egyptians built their columns out of wood in this time period, so the wood is long gone. But it had a clay brick floor, which was a quality dwelling. An ordinary dwelling would not have that, a paved floor. It would have a dirt floor. This is kind of a recreation of the palace, which with its two-room addition in the front. The front addition had a portico as well, but it was nine columns, so they weren't calling any particular number reference in there. But the original portico entrance to the building and the facade got closed into a courtyard in between the two structures. So this indicates that the high rank continued, but it continued to a two-person filling of that office for this palace. And so here's a whole listing of the rooms. And a question mark, could this have been Ephraim and Manasseh carrying on their father's work from this location? Because you can say that matches the biblical account really well. But it gets worse for the skeptic because there's a cemetery out back behind the palace. And there's the documentary, if you see the documentary, they tell you there's 12 graves, significant graves. There's really a lot more graves than that if you look up the archaeological dig records. But there's 12 principal graves, and that's the point they made. One of the graves is unique in that no non-Egyptian was given. In fact, Egyptian individuals of high rank were not allowed to be buried in a pyramid-shaped tomb until the third, or the rather the New Kingdom period. Then you find them all over the place. Here in the Middle Kingdom, even if you were an Egyptian of high rank, you weren't getting buried in a pyramid-shaped tomb. Out back behind the palace is, what do you see there? Pyramid-shaped tomb with a chapel in the front of it for whoever this was, this non-Egyptian vizier. This is a recreation from the documentary that's pretty good. And within the chapel in the front of that tomb was a twice life-size statue of the person honored, which is really significant in the ancient world in that time period. What's really interesting for us is how they found the pieces of that original statue. Evidently, some event occurred where first this tomb was opened and the contents pulled out. And before the tomb was either reused for anybody else or even repaired, a mob came to this tomb and smashed the statue. Then they only found two pieces of the statue within the tomb itself. They were in the trench in front of the opening of the tomb crypt chamber. The two pieces were the top of the head. The face had been smashed and torn apart. There was one shoulder left of the statue. And what they found in those two remnants were kind of the most positive ID pieces you maybe would want to find on this statue. One, that the hair and the coloring, they still had some of the color intact of the paint on the statue when they dug it out. That the hair was red, which is an Asian person, and the skin was painted yellow, and it's a man statue. The Egyptians, the man statue would always be painted more of a brown. They might paint their women yellow, but they painted men brown for an Egyptian. So by hairstyle, by coloring, we know this is a Semite from the Canaan region. And we know that it's smashed. People took after it with hammers. We're really in a rage against this image. On the shoulder is a throwing stick, which is a badge of rank, not all the way up to Pharaoh, but definitely fitting a vizier. On the shoulder, on the back, were still some remnants of paint, and it's a multicolored coat. The center image is a recreation that's probably not accurate. I mean, it even includes some writing that would be down a strip of the road. That's conjecture. You know, and if they did find that, hey, I'm Joseph, in the ground. Of course, game over, but by all the indications, this exactly fits the biblical narrative. Now, the skeptics point out that within the burial chamber itself, they found a couple scraps of bone and a couple scraps of pottery. But when you look at the photograph of the actual day of the dig, and they also pick on this, that shoulder and head segment are not the only places they found some little scrap of this statue back in that garden cemetery. They found another couple few pieces that are kind of filled in on that chart of the statue. They found other little teeny fragments and other pieces of the property from the day of the riot, when they smashed up this statue. But the significant thing is where the statue stood, where the pieces fell into that open trench, the bigger pieces. The other pieces are all smaller that some yelling hooligan could have carried away and then dropped before going home. And that's, you can see the colors here that they found on that remnant.
So that's
Avaris, yeah. Here's the dig on the day they opened up all that tomb in the 1980s. Why nobody knows this, because it's 30-year-old finds, but news gets out slowly, especially when people don't like it. See the dark circle in front of the headpiece has been picked up in the statue on the very right and placed outside the dig trench. Its original place is in the yellow square in the photo on the upper left, where they actually uncovered it as they were scraping down through the dirt. The dark circle on the tomb wall in front on the photo to the right is where the original people that emptied this tomb had cut a hole carefully in the brick pit of the tomb. So they went under the feet of the statue, dug a tunnel over to the brick wall of the pit that had a lid, and then pulled the contents out. The skeptics point out that there's you know, hey, you guys claimed the tomb was empty. It's not empty. We found more pieces. Well, they're there behind this Arab on the right, on the right-hand picture. To his right and to your left in the view are two little columns of dirt in there with some bone and pottery scraps. They're not on the floor. They're up on a dirt mound, which means you can interpret it that they were there, but it's kind of a difficult interpretation to make, because if people were emptying the tomb, why did they push dirt in and then put the bones back on top of the dirt as they were emptying the tomb? Because we see the direction they emptied the tomb from. So the fact that those are on columns of soil means they weren't on the bottom of the tomb. The day the tomb was emptied, the dirt couldn't have been in there. So this had to have come along in the intervening years when the soil's been stripped and other things done and holes dug in a future date. That's more plausible than these were in there on the day of the tomb emptying and they didn't take everything with them. So that's something the skeptics have thrown at this evidence to say, nah, you don't have anything here. But they don't have this photograph and they hope you don't find it. Now this could not be Joseph's tomb. This is kind of like the Shroud of Turin. It looks exactly like what we should expect to find. We'll never be able to prove it 100%. And the skeptic will always throw it out. But it's powerful evidence to an open-minded person. Yeah.
Another interesting thing is that grave diggers, you know, robbers.
They wouldn't take bones.
They go after artifacts. They don't steal the body.
Right.
And in this case, the body is gone.
In this case, the body's gone. Thank you. Because grave robbers, when you find a tomb that's been sacked and grave robbed, they don't take the bones with them. You always find the bones. Here you don't find the bone.
Joseph is taken back.
Because we know the story, right? Another evidence from that time period that's not archaeological, but actually a text evidence. From the 12th dynasty, they found a papyrus. It's kept today in Brooklyn, New York for whatever reason. And it's in the hieratic script of the ancient Egyptians. They had a script that was kind of based on the hieroglyph system that the scribes would write in on papyrus with ink. And this script, I included the original script for you to see. It has a number of Hebrew names. In fact, two-thirds of the list are Hebrew names of a list of owned slaves from the 12th dynasty. So, boom. We don't find a menorah, but we find Hebrew names in a text from that era. And it's a list of slaves, not hirelings. The next thing that happened in the story was that that population went through great hardship under the slavery. And that's what you find in the strata above the good time period for these people. You find that the bones now show extreme duress and short lifespan. And the most significant thing is the high number of infant burials. It jumps way up. Because when they dug all this up, they counted skeletons and they did some study on the demographics and of course the anthropology of who they're finding in the ground. And they find that the female percentage of the population is abnormally high for the burials. They find this high number of infant burials. This is an infant burial from Avaris. And they show that extreme hard labor. Now they're not finding in the strata fancy belts and daggers. It's poor people worked very hard. And they find that the population continues to rise in that strata. Then finally in the top strata, before they identify that the city is abandoned for some time, is plague pits, where bodies are just thrown in on top of each other like this. These are adult males thrown in the grave at the last stage of this city. So all of those pieces are matching the biblical narrative in this archaeology. This may not be the Exodus findings. I have a book here from a Christian author who thinks it occurred back in the first Old Kingdom period of history. I haven't dug through his logic, but it's interesting. But I just got cued to this, and the more I looked, the more I found more backup than this documentary showed me, and pieces of even what he showed, and I also read the skeptic attacks on this. So that's what I'm sharing with you.
Which documentary?
It's called Patterns of Evidence.
It
was on Netflix. I don't think they've pulled it because he wasn't getting paid his royalty. Netflix, and then same with YouTube. It was on YouTube until like a month ago, and it got YouTube pulled it. So I bought his because I thought, you know, it's not right to download it from YouTube if he's getting robbed for his effort. And then again, we have textual evidence of the plague event, which is a lot of skeptics will adamantly claim there is no such thing as any kind of record of the plagues of the Bible that led to the Exodus or were immediately prior to the Exodus. Well, one, there's bones. Two, there's a papyrus text called the Ipuwer Papyrus that dates from that era. It's today held in, I think it's called Leiden in the Netherlands. Scholarship rejects this being a papyrus's record being about the events of the plague. But there's the plague of blood. In the papyrus, it says pestilence is through the land, blood is everywhere. The river is blood. Men shrink and thirst after water. That's in the Ipuwer Papyrus. The plague on the livestock, 5:5 in the Ipuwer Papyrus. All animals, their hearts weep, cattle moan. The plague of hail and fire, oddly enough. From Ipuwer, the fire ran along the ground. There was hail, and fire mingled with the hail. Very odd reference. In Ipuwer, forsooth, help us, gates, columns, and walls are consumed by fire. The locusts are mentioned in Ipuwer. No fruit or herbs are found that the earth would cease from noise and tumult, uproar, be no more. Trees are destroyed and the branches are stripped. In Ipuwer, the plague of darkness. The land is without light. The plague on the firstborn. He who places his brother in the ground is everywhere. Groaning is throughout the land, mingled with lamentations. Forsooth, the children of princes are dashed against the walls. Forsooth, the children of the princes are cast out in the streets. And then the freeing of the slaves, a very interesting reference. In fact, modern scholarship has thrown out one of these as entirely fabricated because it's too ridiculous, in their opinion. It's contradictory. It self-contradicts itself, so it must be a fictional writing by some sort of novelist from the 12th dynasty. The plunderer is everywhere, and the servant takes what he finds. Indeed, poor men have become wealthy. Gold, silver, and jewels are fastened to the necks of slaves. Slaves who have now been freed are throughout the land. The king's storehouse has now become common property. Yeah?
What is the reason the skeptics reject
this? Because they think it's from the wrong time period, so it can't be about the Exodus. That's the principal reason.
You said it was dated that time, though.
It comes from that era of Egyptian history.
Just archaeologically,
right. They date this document to that time frame. By its style, by the papyrus itself, so on. I think it's ridiculous on its face to deny this. And then what about the wandering? I mean, this is a lot of skeptic rant about the Exodus is there's no evidence of 2 million people crossing the desert and they would leave a mark, believe you me. But there's evidence of more emptying of Egypt that dates to this time period. There's a city called Kahun. It's not a city, it's an encampment. It's a very interesting one. The pyramid in the distance in this view on the left is Senusret III's temple complex that this was built near. This was not built on a water place. Water had to be brought to this encampment to give to people. The occupants in it, all the archaeological evidence is Semite people. It's surrounded by a high wall, guard towers. It's placed so that you can guard against people leaving it, not for it to be even that convenient for the workers to be building the temple complex. And it's abandoned all at one time in that era. Everything gets left, people walk out, and the city falls into disrepair and gets covered by dirt eventually. So there's a general abandonment of a Semitic encampment.
So there's no artifacts or anything there, right?
There's tons of artifacts, and it identifies them as
something that would be brought with people, like, or there's
well, I would say it doesn't indicate that people walked out and had nothing. You couldn't make that conclusion from what you find, but you can conclude that who they were from the evidence. And this is kind of a little map of where that, the red square is that actual city near the Thayum Basin, and the little hard to see yellow box with an X in it is the pyramid of that pharaoh, who might be the pharaoh that Moses took his people out from. Then also, one of the traditional routes of the Exodus, you know, everybody's got in their Bible different routes for the Exodus through Sinai. And the traditional one that everybody kind of clung to in the time of Constantine, Constantine's mother established the monastery of St. Catherine at the tip of Sinai near Mount Horeb, they call it. And the traditional route goes down the west side of the Sinai Peninsula. Well, what's there? The lower right photo is a temple complex that the Egyptians kept. It wasn't really officially Egypt, but they had a temple there because that was one of their principal copper mines, and obviously they were using a lot of that metal for Egypt, but they didn't have the mines in the Nile region. They had it over in Sinai. And is evidence of, what we find is evidence that the slaves were a Semitic group until a certain date, and then they're gone. And the certain date they're there to is roughly in the time period we're looking for. So we have an emptying of Semitic servant peoples from Egypt in this time period. It's hard to date these that tight. I would avoid that. I would avoid getting into a controversy over chronology because people with PhDs are rumbling about this. This is kind of simple. It dates to that time period. It's within the margin of error to fall exactly in within the story's context without getting into a scholarly controversy of
aren't scholars debating
points.
About a 200-year delta?
Yes.
Shift this way?
Right. And a lot of that. And a lot of that is based on that they've made some other finds of genealogical Russians, records carved in rocks in Egypt. Some of them are near the Red Sea out in the desert that almost nobody goes to. Some of it is the dating from astronomical events that have caused people to rethink whether the established chronology is sound and can't be challenged. There's a lot of challenge going on. There's actually a fair amount of controversy within the field by the serious people involved with it. And you can leave it there. For the wandering, that's one's difficult. And again, I wouldn't say that we would expect to find the wandering. Why would you? They're living in tents. They're packing everything with them. What are you expecting to find? Foundations? You shouldn't expect it. But there have been digs. It should be noted to do as well. If anybody you're talking with about this, the Sinai, there's no archaeology going on in it before the 20th century, really of note. There's been a few digs in there. But most of the attention's over in the interesting stuff along the Nile. And there's not many windows within the 20th century once Israel comes into being in 48. What happens in the Sinai, it's held by the Egyptians for most of that time period. Are the Egyptians interested in looking for evidence of the Hebrews along the wandering path? No, they're not. The only digs to look for things like that have been by Hebrew or Israelite archaeologists. There's one, Rudolf Cohen did some digs, and he actually found some forts that date to like the Solomonic era and different Hebrew kings that show the extent that all of our Bible maps show of the extent of Solomon's kingdom and all that. Well, the evidence is like in that fort on the right in this image. They found the forts. They haven't found underneath the forts Hebrew property that the Israelites fleeing Egypt stayed in the same spot. In fact, the digging underneath these forts goes down to undisturbed strata. So the forts are the first thing on that particular plot, but the fort's not that big. So you can't really say you've dug up the whole thing. Most of the Sinai is not accumulating new dirt except for when sand blows around. Yes?
Yeah, that's kind of my question. I mean,
Well, for one thing, most of the Sinai is a military reservation under modern Egyptian control. You don't really get to roam around out there without getting the Egyptian army's permission.
Okay, but physically is it more difficult because of sand? I mean, you see these pictures of sand.
Well, I would say this. If it's raw territory and it's not got a river bringing in new silt, what's going to cover artifacts? Not much. So most of the territory is open ground, so if anything is interesting that is there, it's going to get picked up by a Bedouin wandering. It's not going to stay. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
One Israeli general, whoever, remarked that a tank left over from the 67 war was under either 40 or 80 feet of sand.
Yeah, sand dunes sort of come and they bury quite a bit.
Buried.
Right. They found it like 20 years later. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Mara? Yes. Well, to a degree. There's controversy about her digs at Jericho because she was, and some of the people, they call it multichrome or polychrome pottery. And they question whether she really was reading the shapes of the pottery found exactly correctly. And it's not easy. It's not easy, right? I mean, they're very similar pots from different eras. How do you tell what age a pot was made, because there's no, they're all clay, so there's very little chance of radiocarbon dating a potsherd accurately. Most of the dating is done anthropologically by what shape it is to date the era of the pottery, and a lot of the dating of the cities in the ancient world are done by pottery that they dig up with that strata. So some people have questioned whether she got the shapes exactly right in what she found. That's where I'm ending today, because if I launch into the conquest, we'll spend another hour, and I'm there. But we could do that another time if you guys want. But there's fascinating things in Jericho, especially. Jericho is the most startling thing where people have found things that match the Bible story, including Rahab's apartment, the structure of the walls, how they fell, the burning layer, the fact that there was grain in the city and obviously got taken fast. A lot of things that they've dug out of the ground that match the biblical narrative in astonishing ways. But the whole thing is thrown out because of chronology. And so...
I've heard you're part of... I've heard there's an archaeological group that meets once a month. Are you part of that? Are you
no.
the leader of it? Or?
No. I saw this video and it was interesting, so I started poking around. This is really well produced. I really recommend. It's no longer on YouTube. It's no longer on Netflix. I think no. Netflix still has this. If you have Netflix at home, this is on Netflix currently. They haven't dropped it yet. It's called Patterns of Evidence: Exodus. It was produced by a Christian filmmaker named. Well, I should get off his book. Tim Mahoney. This is Tim Mahoney. It's a companion book that came with the video for cheap on Amazon. If you want to dig into the chronology, there is a agnostic, non-Christian Egyptian scholar who has really kind of not had the antipathy toward the Bible that other people in academia have. He looks at it as an ancient document. He completely rejects the idea of miracles. So he's verifiably not on our side. But he does a lot of interesting, he has a lecture series, and he's so interesting. I got this book by him of chronicling the people of the Bible, which is beyond the Exodus story, through there. His chapter on Adam is complete bunk, you'll laugh. But at least it tells you this is not a sympathetic witness. And he is a major player in the current scholastic controversy over the Egyptian chronologies and whether they've been right all along or not.
How does he feel about the plague?
Well, he finds that evidence in Ippiwer. Ippiwer is a pretty strong reference that matches the biblical account so astonishingly from an ancient reference. That you would rank it up there with finding Tacitus or Josephus or any other ancient Roman historian verifying the Gospels. In fact, even more so. So he takes that as an ancient document that you should take at face value and consider what it shows. So it's fascinating what he's come up with, because a lot of his stuff is dealing with the chronology, which I can see from a few heads is going to bore people too bad. You know, if we're in an active topic of what people are doing, it's a lot easier to follow. So thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Jesus, thank you for having you, Ross, address our church today. Lord, may it have fruit. May SMCC be restored as a church bringing people to Christ. May this class function as it has in bringing people to Christ. And Lord, just thank you so much for the interest and energy of this class, this fellowship of Christians ready to defend the Bible and ready to explain to people why our faith is a reasonable one. In Jesus' name, amen.